Welcome to Mayo Clinic Pharmacy Grand Rounds, a weekly podcast for pharmacists, physicians, physician assistants, and nurse practitioners who are interested in learning more about clinical pharmacology topics. I'm your host, Garrett Schramm, Director of Pharmacy Education and Academic Affairs at Mayo Clinic. To claim pharmacology CE credit or to get a copy of presentation slides, visit ce.mayo.edu/pharmacypodcast. In recent decades, obesity prevalence has nearly tripled, with 13% of the world's adults meeting criteria. With over 200,000 bariatric surgeries performed annually, this has become the mainstay of treatment. Understanding changes in response to anticoagulant therapy after bariatric surgery is crucial due to the elevated thrombotic risk. But little is known about the safety and efficacy of direct oral anticoagulants in comparison to warfarin. Dr. Danielle Hess, a clinical pharmacist at Mayo Clinic, guides us through the appropriate anticoagulation options and their efficacy for the bariatric surgery population.
In recent decades, the worldwide prevalence of obesity has nearly tripled, as 13% of the world's adult population was categorized as obese in 2016. With over 200,000 bariatric surgeries performed annually, this has become the mainstay treatment for morbid obesity due to its ability to achieve significant weight loss and its demonstrated efficacy in improving obesity-related comorbidities. Obesity is an independent risk factor for venous thromboembolism, and due to the elevated risk in this patient population, it is crucial to understand the changes in response to anticoagulation after bariatric surgery. Management of anticoagulation not only requires a balance of the underlying thrombotic risk in this patient population against the hemorrhagic surgical complication risk, but it also requires an understanding of the long-term consequences of a modified gastrointestinal anatomy. Although direct oral anticoagulants, or DOACs, have become favored for many different indications, little is known about the safety or efficacy of these agents in comparison to the traditional option of warfarin after bariatric surgery. Therefore, today we will go through the different pharmacotherapy measures that may be affected by an altered GI tract. We will also look at the literature available for warfarin use after bariatric surgery. And finally, we will discuss the safety and efficacy of DOACs after bariatric surgery. So this brings us to our first poll question. If you could log on to pollev.com/MayoRx or text MayoRx to 22333. This is just a poll to gauge the audience opinion on this question, and then we will revisit this question at the end of the presentation. So we have a 40-year-old female with creatinine clearance greater than 100 milliliters per minute, status post-bariatric surgery in July 2020, who is admitted for a new DVT of her left lower leg. The medicine service asks for your recommendation on long-term anticoagulation. Which would you recommend, barring no issues with insurance? A, warfarin, B, apixaban, C, rivaroxaban, D, edoxaban, or E, dabigatran. So as I mentioned, I won't share my opinion with this case yet, but as we go through the presentation, we'll revisit this at the end and see if our responses have changed. But for right now, we'll keep in mind that the most popular option is warfarin, followed by apixaban. Bariatric surgery is currently the most successful and durable option for treatment of morbid obesity. Overall, bariatric surgery can be classified as either having restrictive properties or malabsorptive properties. Of the types of bariatric surgery, we have the three most common listed on the screen. First of all, restrictive procedures are categorized as having a reduced amount of food that can be consumed at a given time. This would then decrease the total caloric intake. On the other hand, in a malabsorptive process, this would create a diversion around a significant portion of the digestive tract, thus leading to a decrease in the absorption of consumed products. Therefore, I would like to go through the three most common types of bariatric surgery in a little bit more depth to provide that background as we go through the evidence. So first of all, just to give you an idea of what is the most common, vertical sleeve gastrectomy is the most commonly performed in the United States, followed by Roux-en-Y gastric bypass, and finally adjustable gastric banding. As you can see in the adjustable gastric band, an adjustable band is placed around the upper portion of the stomach. This creates a smaller channel between the upper and lower section of the stomach with the goal of reducing total caloric intake. Overall, this would then be categorized as a restrictive procedure because we are decreasing the functional size of the stomach. Next, we have Roux-en-Y gastric bypass. As you can see in this image, a small pouch is created for the stomach at the top, and then this is connected to the middle intestine. Here, we are going around majority of the stomach, bypassing the entire duodenum and even part of the jejunum. Here, this is then a combination of both restrictive and malabsorptive properties, because not only are we creating a smaller stomach, but we are also bypassing that significant portion of the GI tract. Therefore, this can lead to an increase in gut peptides like GLP-1. It can also lead to a faster intestinal transit time, and finally, a faster gastric emptying rate. Finally, we have sleeve gastrectomy, and here you can see this is a non-reversible procedure because we're performing a partial gastrectomy and only leaving the lesser curvature of the stomach and the pylorus. Therefore, this is again a restrictive procedure, and we are also removing some of or all of the cells that are releasing the orexigenic hormone ghrelin, which then can lead to a decrease in hunger as well. In addition to the caloric absorption restrictions caused by bariatric surgery, they also possess the unintended potential to affect the pharmacokinetic properties of drugs. Therefore, after days, months, or years after bariatric surgery, the changes on pharmacokinetics can differ from patient to patient and depend on the type of bariatric surgery performed. Thus, I would like to take a step back to the basics of pharmacokinetics and go through each of the steps in a little bit of depth to understand how absorption, distribution, metabolism, and excretion may be impacted by bariatric surgery. So to start us off with absorption, there are a number of factors that can be influencing absorption, including changes in gastric motility, gastric volume, gastric pH, surface area, and carrier proteins. And because this is a large number of different factors that may be impacting absorption, I want to break this down even a little bit further with an illustration. So as I mentioned, the different bariatric surgeries are classified as either restrictive, malabsorptive, or a combination of the two. Therefore, depending on the type of bariatric surgery, these influences of absorption may differ. But for the purposes of this illustration, I would like to focus on Roux-en-Y gastric bypass, as this appears to have the largest gastrointestinal anatomy changes compared to our normal GI tract. So first, let's take a look of a drug going through a normal GI tract on the left-hand side. So as you can see, the drug comes into contact with plenty of the gastric volume, and then it will continue on with the tract and eventually go through metabolism, distribution, and finally excretion from the body. However, if we take a look at the Roux-en-Y gastric bypass on the right, as you can see, this drug is bypassing a significant portion of our GI tract. There's also a number of factors that can be influencing the absorption here. For one, there's a smaller amount of volume in that small pouch of the stomach. Therefore, that means there's also a smaller amount of solvent available to help with the disintegration and dissolution of our drugs. Additionally, we have where the gastric pH typically becomes a little bit more alkaline after bariatric surgery, with a pH of about 4 to 6. That means with basic drugs, the solubility may decrease, but with acidic drugs, the solubility may increase. Finally, in the significant portion of the GI tract that is being bypassed here, especially in the proximal small intestine, there are a number of carrier proteins, including influx transporters and efflux pumps. Therefore, dependent on the type of drug, these may also influence absorption. So what does this mean for our drugs overall with absorption? It would likely mean that there's a potential overall decrease in the absorption of drugs. Next, we can look at distribution. So with bariatric surgery, there is a significant amount of weight loss, which leads to changes in distribution patterns. So for example, if we look at our lipophilic drugs, per se, warfarin, that is a lipophilic drug, if there's a decrease in the adipose tissue, there could be a decrease in the distribution of the drug, and maybe you would need a smaller dose of that drug. Additionally, with metabolism, there can be a decrease in the contact with our gastrointestinal CYP enzymes. As we know, a lot of metabolism occurs in the liver, but there is also a high expression of certain CYP enzymes in the proximal intestine. For example, CYP3A substrates can be very impacted by not being metabolized if they're bypassing this area. In addition, CYP2C9, CYP2C19, CYP2D6, some of the UGTs, and to a lesser extent, some of the phase 2 enzymes are also present in this proximal intestine. Therefore, for an example, with warfarin that is predominantly metabolized by CYP2C9, we could see a decrease in the metabolism in that area of the small intestine, especially for Roux-en-Y gastric bypass. This would then lead to a decrease in metabolism and a potential increase in drug concentrations, or if we have a prodrug, that could lead to a decrease in the drug activation and a decrease in those drug concentrations. For excretion, if we have that decrease in drug metabolism, that could lead to a slower drug elimination. And finally, that could lead to an increase in our drug accumulation. This leads us to our second question. So again, if you could join at pollev.com/MayoRx or text MayoRx to 22333. Which of the following pharmacokinetic changes occur after common bariatric surgeries? A, decreased gastric volume leading to more fluid acting as solvent. B, increased contact with stomach and intestinal surface area. C, decrease in adipose tissue leading to a decrease in the distribution of lipophilic drugs. Or D, faster drug elimination due to a shorter GI tract. I agree with the majority here. A decrease in adipose tissue leading to a decrease in distribution. This was like the example I gave with warfarin being a lipophilic drug. To go through the other answers, a decreased gastric volume leading to more fluid acting as solvent. This is correct in the beginning, but that would also lead to a decrease in the solvent available. B, we actually have a decreased contact with stomach and intestinal surface area, especially in the Roux-en-Y gastric bypass, where we're bypassing a significant portion of the digestive tract. And finally, D, it would typically lead to a slower drug elimination through these different factors, especially if we have less of a drug metabolism. Due to the many significant GI anatomy changes that we discussed and the known increased thrombotic risk in this patient population, it is crucial to understand the different changes that may affect warfarin dosing after bariatric surgery. Although there is a significant introduction of the newer direct oral anticoagulant options, a significant portion of patients remain on warfarin therapy. An estimated 3% of patients undergoing bariatric surgery have chronic warfarin therapy. And it's important to note that this is only the number of patients who were already on warfarin before bariatric surgery and does not include the number of patients that may need it months to years after bariatric surgery. And finally, perioperative management of warfarin typically involves bridging with the shorter acting and easily reversible low molecular weight heparin or unfractionated heparin, in addition to intensive INR monitoring to ensure that the patient remains in their therapeutic target for their INR values. To provide a little bit of background on warfarin, it is absorbed primarily in the proximal duodenum. And to give an example here with Roux-en-Y gastric bypass, if we circle the proximal duodenum, we see that this is being bypassed by this type of surgery. This is important to keep in mind as we look at the different evidence for warfarin after bariatric surgery. This could lead to a theoretical need for increasing the warfarin dose overall. Additionally, the diet is very important after bariatric surgery. This table is actually present in the Ask Mayo Expert patient education materials for patients after surgery. And this shows that immediately after bariatric surgery, the recommended diet is protein drinks plus clear liquids for about the first week. And then as we progress, for a minimum of at least about 11 to 12 weeks, we are finally then reintroducing solid food. So this is a long period of time where warfarin dosing may be difficult because it could be very difficult to have a consistent amount of vitamin K-rich foods in these dietary changes. So this brings us to our first study regarding warfarin dosing around bariatric surgery. Strong and colleagues created this retrospective review of patients on chronic warfarin therapy before Roux-en-Y gastric bypass or sleeve gastrectomy. Patients were gathered from 2008 to 2015 retrospectively for these two types of bariatric surgeries. As you can see from this flow diagram, with almost 4,000 bariatric surgeries, 128 of the patients were on warfarin therapy, and of those patients, 53 had available INR values. So with this study, they wanted to look at the trends of the total warfarin dose after bariatric surgery compared to preoperative doses. It's also important to note that warfarin was restarted about an average of 2.9 days after bariatric surgery was performed. So here we can see this is the result graph for the Roux-en-Y gastric bypass group. They were looking at the total warfarin weekly dose. They avoided the daily dose because of alterations in daily dosing. So total warfarin weekly dose was a little bit more accurate or easy to look at. And as you can see, they looked at baseline and then again at 1, 6, 12, and 36 months after bariatric surgery. And here we can see with our p-values, there were two times in which there was a statistically significant decrease in the warfarin dose. As you can see, the drop at 1 month was the highest drop. And this relates to that dietary change table that we just discussed as well, where this is the time period where we may see the most changes in diet affecting warfarin. Next, we can look at the sleeve gastrectomy results. Here you can see the same time periods were measured, and there were 3 points in time in which there was a statistically significant decrease in the weekly warfarin dose. Although there was a slightly smaller reduction after 1 month compared to the Roux-en-Y gastric bypass, there was still a significant reduction. So overall, this study took the theory of warfarin dosing likely changes after bariatric surgery and actually tested that theory. So overall, they showed us that warfarin dosing is expected to be reduced by about 25% following bariatric surgery. This was also the largest study of patients on warfarin immediately post-bariatric surgery, with 53 patients in this study. Finally, as we saw from the graphs, the initial dietary changes have the largest impact, but with INR monitoring, this study showed us that we still can use warfarin dosing. We may just need to be a little bit more diligent right after the bariatric surgery occurs. Now that we have the framework from Strong and Colleagues' study, this brings us to a study by Irwin and colleagues who took it a step further and did a retrospective matched cohort study of patients on chronic warfarin before bariatric surgery. In this study, they looked at a number of patients on Roux-en-Y gastric bypass or patients undergoing gastric banding. They then matched these patients with controls based on the date of surgery, their age, and target INR. The different surgeries that were performed in this study were the cholecystectomy or the ERCP, or a combination of one of these with another abdominal surgery. This brings us to the results of this study, where they again were looking at the trends of warfarin dosing after bariatric surgery. To orientate you a bit to this graph, you can see on the left their mean weekly warfarin dose is labeled, and then the mean INR is on the right. Our pink lines represent our bariatric surgery groups, whereas the control is in blue. Additionally, you can see the date of surgery in about the middle of this graph. So this shows that we do have a statistically significant decrease in our warfarin dose, especially between weeks about 3 to 8. And then it slowly went back up after about 26 weeks. Overall, this study showed that 74.1% of bariatric surgery patients experienced a decrease of at least 20% or more compared to their preoperative dose. Overall, this study was very similar to Strong and Colleagues because it showed that although Strong and Colleagues had a 25% decrease, this was very similar with a 20% decrease following bariatric surgery. Overall, it is important to note that this outcome was strictly driven by the Roux-en-Y gastric bypass patients, as the subgroup of gastric banding patients had no statistically significant differences in their preoperative and postoperative warfarin weekly doses. Finally, this study was strengthened by the use of a matched control group to address the confounding effect of abdominal surgery. So it was nice to have that comparison between the two groups. Overall, our studies here have demonstrated that the decrease in warfarin after bariatric surgery may be due to a number of different factors. We see that there is an increase in the warfarin sensitivity after bariatric surgery, and this may be due to the dietary changes immediately after, but it also may be due to one of the theories saying that with the more basic or alkaline environment in the stomach after bariatric surgery, there actually may be more unionized warfarin available for passive absorption as well. So there's a number of factors that we're looking at. Also with Roux-en-Y gastric bypass, like I mentioned earlier, if there's less metabolism through CYP2C9 in that proximal and small intestine, that may be another factor inhibiting warfarin from being metabolized as much as previously. And finally, overall, this showed that we still can use warfarin, but there may be an increased need for INR monitoring immediately after bariatric surgery until about those 26 weeks or a couple months that we saw between the two studies. So that brings us to our next PoleEV question. You can join on poleev.com/MayoRx or text MayoRx to 22333. Based on the evidence presented, which of the common types of bariatric surgery has the largest impact on warfarin dosing? A, sleeve gastrectomy, B, Roux-en-Y gastric bypass, C, gastric banding, or D, duodenal switch? I agree with the majority on this question, Roux-en-Y gastric bypass. To go through the other options, sleeve gastrectomy, it did have a statistically significant reduction in total weekly warfarin dosing, but not as significant as Roux-en-Y. With gastric banding, I'm glad no one chose this one. As we mentioned with Irwin and colleagues, there was no statistically significant decrease in the warfarin dosing with gastric banding. And finally, with duodenal switch, this is a more historical type of bariatric surgery that was unfortunately not present in the studies that I looked at. And this brings us to our discussion on DOACs after bariatric surgery. As I mentioned, DOACs have become favored for a number of indications, and with the increased thrombotic risk, these may be a great option for our bariatric patients. However, there is little known about the safety and efficacy of these compared to warfarin. Overall, they do expand the spectrum of anticoagulation, and they do have fixed doses available. However, these fixed doses were determined according to patients with normal GI anatomy, as patients with significant alterations to their GI tract were not included in phase 2 and phase 3 trials for these drugs. Finally, the DOACs differ in terms of site and degree of absorption and metabolism pathways. Therefore, this adds a bit of a complexity as the different types of DOACs may respond differently to the different types of bariatric surgery as well. As we discussed with the warfarin absorption, I would like to demonstrate where the DOACs are absorbed in the body as well, and we'll use sleeve gastrectomy as an example. So for apixaban, you can see with the solid black circle, this is the primary absorption site in the proximal intestine for apixaban, where the dashed line represents minimal absorption sites. For dabigatran, we can see that it's primarily absorbed in the lower stomach and the proximal duodenum. With rivaroxaban, its primary absorption is in the stomach and then minimally in the proximal small intestine. And finally, with edoxaban, it is primarily absorbed in the proximal small intestine. Of the studies depicting DOAC use after bariatric surgery, Kroll and colleagues created a single-center, open-label, non-randomized phase 1 clinical trial to look at rivaroxaban 10 milligram doses before and after bariatric surgery. Here, they had 6 patients in their Roux-en-Y gastric bypass group and 6 in their sleeve gastrectomy group. These patients were undergoing a planned bariatric surgery in 2015, so this was a prospective study. Here you can see the venous blood sample timeframes at which they drew samples to see where the levels of rivaroxaban were at these given times. And these are the results for Roux-en-Y gastric bypass on the left and sleeve gastrectomy on the right. And as we can see, the overall systemic exposure between these two types of bariatric surgery are very similar to the preoperative lines, which are blue on the graph, where postoperative was pink. In particular, you can see that in the Roux-en-Y, the rivaroxaban concentration, or the Cmaxes for this drug, were a little bit lower than preoperatively, where the opposite was seen with sleeve gastrectomy, where postoperative Cmax values were slightly higher than the preoperative values. Overall, this study measured not only the preoperative, postoperative timeframes, but it also did an extension study to look at. We know we have a significant amount of weight loss with bariatric surgery. Will these rivaroxaban levels be affected 6 to 8 months later? So this showed us that they were not affected, and they were very similar to the preoperative doses. This then supports the concept that the pharmacology of rivaroxaban is not significantly affected by bariatric surgery. However, it is important to note that they did have a limited sample size and single administrations of rivaroxaban. However, rivaroxaban does not see a great amount of accumulation after multiple doses. Therefore, the authors assumed that the single administration would be representative of multiple doses of rivaroxaban for these patients. Next, we have a study by Rottenstreck and colleagues, and this study re-challenged the Kroll and colleagues study by doing a cross-sectional matched cohort study of patients on chronic DOAC therapy. They gathered patients from 2005 to 2016, and in this matched cohort, matched the patients on age, gender, BMI, and serum creatinine. As you can see, they also added in adjustable gastric banding in addition to the Roux-en-Y gastric bypass and sleeve gastrectomy. Additionally, they also added in two different types of DOAC agents, including dabigatran and apixaban. Of these patients, apixaban was the most prevalent DOAC used. Here, with this study, the authors measured the number of cases versus the number of cases that looked or that fell within the expected drug levels for these specific DOACs. Therefore, they looked at the peak levels 3 hours after rivaroxaban, 3 hours after apixaban, and 2 hours after dabigatran. As you can see in this graph, rivaroxaban had 7 cases, but only 2 of these cases fell within the drug level that would be expected for rivaroxaban. However, dabigatran and apixaban, with 2 patients and 9 patients, all fell within expected drug levels for these different DOAC agents. Overall, this left us with the question of whether or not there are adequate absorptions of the DOAC agents, especially in rivaroxaban, as this contradicted with the results from the Kroll and colleagues study. However, they did not study whether the lower drug peaks correlated with poorer clinical outcomes. And additionally, this was limited by sample size and because there were a variety of DOACs and also a variety of the types of bariatric surgery, so this made each group very small. Now that I've discussed studies both on DOACs and warfarin, I would like to discuss a study that looked at both DOACs and warfarin after bariatric surgery. This was a retrospective matched cohort study by Hendricks and colleagues who looked at non-valvular atrial fibrillation patients treated with an oral anticoagulant. They used insurance claim data to look at patients from 2010 to 2018 who had undergone bariatric surgery and were on an oral anticoagulant. As you can see here, with the large number of bariatric surgeries performed, 933 were identified to be on warfarin, where 740 were identified to be on DOAC therapy. Of the DOACs identified in this study, apixaban was the most commonly seen. The 3 primary outcomes of this study were looking at whether the prevalence of stroke or systemic embolism, major bleed, or death increased or not between the non-bariatric and bariatric patients. As you can see in this table with these 3 primary outcomes, if we look at the p-values all the way to the right, there was no statistical difference between the non-bariatric and bariatric patients. Thus, the authors of this study took it a step further with their secondary outcomes and looked at whether or not these primary outcomes could be applied to DOAC versus warfarin. And here, again, if we look at the p-values, we can see that there was, again, no statistically significant difference between these clinical outcomes and whether or not a patient was on a DOAC versus warfarin. This study not only looked at similar rates of ischemic stroke, systemic embolism, or major bleeding for non-bariatric versus bariatric patients, but they took that step further and looked at warfarin versus DOACs. Therefore, they were the first study to compare warfarin to DOACs post-bariatric surgery, and they were also the largest study to date looking at clinical outcomes after bariatric surgery. One limitation of this study could be the insurance claim billing code data that was used, because ICD codes can be misclassified or underrepresented, especially for obesity. So from these studies, we have demonstrated that there is a variability in DOAC levels post-bariatric surgery. Again, there are differing sites of absorption and metabolic pathways that add complexity to determine whether or not the safety is applicable for this class after bariatric surgery. And finally, DOACs are favored in other indications because of their fewer dietary restrictions, minimal drug-drug interactions, and standardized dosing. And as we saw from these studies, we may be able to apply our non-bariatric information to our bariatric patients. So this leads us to revisiting our first Poll EV question. And if you could join at pollev.com/MayoRx or text MayoRx to 22333. Again, it is a 40-year-old female with a creatinine clearance greater than 100 milliliters per minute, status post-bariatric surgery in July 2020, who is admitted for a new DVT of her lower left leg. If the medicine clinic asks for your opinion on long-term anticoagulation, which would you choose barring no issues with insurance? I agree with the majority in this question, choosing apixaban. And the reason for my choice would be that this is several months after the bariatric surgery has occurred. So we're not seeing those changes that may be occurring, especially due to diet. We also are looking at a new DVT, which is a bit of a lower risk compared to some of the other indications for DOACs or warfarin. And additionally, if we go through the other options, warfarin is definitely okay to use. Some people like to have that closer look at the INR, especially after bariatric surgery, to ensure that their patient is falling within the therapeutic range. Rivaroxaban has been shown to have the highest rate of major bleeds, so I would steer away from that, especially with the increased bleeding versus thrombotic risk in this patient population. And with edoxaban and dabigatran, we just don't normally see these. Especially with edoxaban, it's typically not used after a creatinine clearance greater than 95, and here we have a creatinine clearance greater than 100. So as you can see from my presentation, unfortunately, there is no clear algorithm that we can use to choose between warfarin or a DOAC agent for our patients following bariatric surgery. However, we can take all of this clinical evidence and apply it to our practices to ensure that there is safe and efficacious agents being used, dependent on individual factors for these patients. Therefore, I will show you my opinions based on warfarin versus DOAC for a number of given indications. I would typically fall, as you could see from the last question, on the side of DOAC use, especially if a patient had uncomplicated surgery, if they had a DVT like in our previous question, and also if they had a low CHADS-2 score. And this kind of relates back to the BRIDGE trial that looked at non-valvular AFib patients around invasive surgeries and whether or not they should receive bridging based on if they had a low or intermediate risk. Here they showed that there was actually just an increased risk of bleeding and not an increased risk of complications following the surgical procedure if you didn't bridge. Therefore, I may be even comfortable waiting about 5 to 7 days to start a DOAC if the provider was not comfortable starting it immediately after the bariatric surgery. On the other hand, it is important to know when to step back to the traditional option of warfarin. And of those indications, if a patient had a complicated surgical course, maybe this would make it a little bit harder to ensure that the DOAC was appropriate for the patient, and we could monitor the patient a little bit closer with our INR monitoring. Additionally, if a patient had a higher risk, such as a pulmonary embolism, this is another reason I may use warfarin. But even with pulmonary embolisms, we can look at the pulmonary embolism severity index and look at whether or not it is a high risk versus low risk, and we may be able to balance whether or not they can use warfarin or a DOAC. And finally, with high risk of complications. For instance, if I had a patient with atrial fibrillation and a history of stroke, I may be leaning more towards warfarin because of the higher risk of complications with this patient. So overall, you can see that it's very individualized, and we're applying the limited amount of information that we do have.
If you enjoyed this episode and want to hear more, subscribe using iTunes or your favorite podcasting app. Thank you for listening to Mayo Clinic Pharmacy Grand Rounds. Join us weekly for more exciting clinical pharmacology topics.